Chapter 23, The Evening Lecture, by A.T. Jones. In continuing this part of my subject, I want to show further that Constantine was a Christian only from political motives, and a pagan always from conviction. He read from Milman's Christianity to show that up to the time of his acceptance of the head of the church, he was outwardly pagan, that the statues erected by him to Apollo show him to have been his favorite god. In 312, he claims to have seen a vision of the cross, and he erected a holy standard in honor of this vision and Christ. You remember I told you about the dreaming of Maxentius and its comparison to the dreaming of Pharaoh. It was at this time Constantine assumed the garb of a Christian. But as Milman says, it was the Christianity of the warrior. And he said his Barbarites showed the same pagan heart as before. In the Labarum he erected the blended symbols of both Christianity and the images of himself and family. Because the image of the emperor was always worshipped by the Romans, so that both Christians and pagans could worship at it. One of his titles was Penitix Maximus. The superstition of his youth, says Milman in substance, clung to him. And speaking of the prophecy pillar, the head of Constantine was substituted for that of Apollo, and then asks, is this paganism approximating to Christianity, or Christianity degenerating to paganism? Dr. Schaff says, Constantine adopted Christianity as a superstition. In fact, the bishops were afraid to compel him to be baptized for fear he would renounce Christianity and turn pagan again and become very jealous of a pagan philosopher, Sapetes, who is a friend of Constantine, fearing he would turn pagan under his influence. So trumped up a charge against him, and he was hastily executed. After his death, no one could tell if he had been a Christian. Milman says that he did not want to alienate his heathen friend, while the Christians did not dare to proceed too far in their efforts to force him to excel his authority in abolishing paganism, so that all the time paganism was openly professed and was the religion of the empire confronting Christianity, so that after his death both religions vied for Constantine. He was deified by the pagans and worshipped by the Christians. Stanley, in his History of the Christian Church, says, so passed away the first Christian emperor, the first defender of the faith, the first imperial patron of the papal see, and of the whole Eastern Church, the founder of the holy places, pagan and Christian, orthodox and heretical, liberal and fanatical, not to be initiated or admired, but much to be remembered, and deeply to be studied. Now these are some of the authentic records of history, so you can judge to some extent what kind of man Constantine was. Now, the Sunday legislation of Constantine. Reading from Neander, quoting from Sozomen, read the second of the first Sunday law to show it was in behalf of both pagans and Christians. This is the law that was not preserved, only the second remaining. This one embodied Friday as well as Sunday. The date of this law is unknown. The purpose was that the day might be devoted to devotion. Now remember that the Romans had festival days, but no days set apart for worship. So it is not correct to say that Sunday was a day of worship among the pagans. That is a papal idea, solely setting it apart for worship, separate from the other days. This is why Constantine called it the Venerable Day of the Sun, because he did not dare to offend the pagans. The Christians, then, were worshipping the sun. The church would first receive a person as a catechumen, and these would turn first to the west, the realm of Satan, and then turning to the east to worship the S-U-N, Sun of Righteousness. Changing the pagan worship of the sun to the Sun of Righteousness. The law of 321 you are familiar with, compelling town people to rest on Sunday. Milman says the rescript for the religious observance of Sunday, which enjoined the suspension of all public business and private labor, was enacted for the whole Roman Empire. Yet unless we had direct proof, that the decree set forth the Christian reason for the sanctity of the day, it may be doubted whether the act would not be received by the greater part of the empire as merely adding one more festival to the fast day of the empire. Have we this direct proof? No. I read what Melman says. The rescript commanding the celebration of the Christian Sabbath bears no allusion to its peculiar sanctity as a Christian institution. When this Sunday law was made, it embraced the whole Roman world, and Constantine had a prayer written that both Christians and pagans could apply to the God they worshipped, and the soldiers were drawn up in line and forced to repeat it in unison. This law was given solely to please the bishops, who had transferred the sanctity of God's Sabbath to the counterfeit of their theocracy, prevailing upon the emperor to force their desired observance of it, so the day as a day of worship is papal entirely. Milman calls this the new paganism, because pagans could acquiesce without scruple in its observance. Now all this shows that Sunday has no civil basis. It was religious in every particular. Did God ordain it? No. Did Caesar ordain it? No. It sprang from the church, having its basis in paganism. So then it is never to be rendered to God, to the state, or to anyone in heaven or earth. The bishops had to have this institution to complete their theocracy and to compel the people to act in conformity with their idea. Now there were people living then that knew this was in opposition to all known rites, and the bishops knew it too. The speaker read again from Alexander to show that the custom in the church was established by a synodal law that all Christians should abstain from labor on Sunday, but it was made more effective by the use of the power of the state through the making of the Sunday law. The same 29th canon that established this custom is the same one who cursed anyone for keeping the Sabbath of the Lord. Can there be any better fulfillment of the prophecy that says he shall think to change times and law? There is where the papacy made their effort to change the law of God. Now, for some of the reasons the bishops gave for obtaining these Sunday laws. Of course, all the men compelled to be idle drifted into the circuses and theaters, and such vast crowds would attend that large numbers of men had to be employed, and so Christians were hired. So the bishops argued that the people going to such places made it necessary for the circuses and theaters to employ extra hands, and so compel Christians to work against their will. So Mandan says that in 326, all kinds of labor were prohibited. And so, on festival days, the circuses and theaters greatly interfered with the worship of the church, and argued that the people would be worshipers if it was not for the greater attraction of the shows. So they asked for laws that would compel them to observe the Sunday. Now the very arguments used then are now being used, almost word for word, and if we could have access to the Vatican Library, the similarity would, no doubt, be more apparent. The bishops claimed then that the circuses and theaters were persecuting Christians by compelling them to work on Sunday, and they called it persecution. The very same thing is said now of the railroads, etc. Now, having compelled men to be idle, that they might be devoted, they were compelled to take away their amusement, to force them to be devoted. So will it be now. Not only that, but they must put devotion in the place of amusement to keep them from hell, and start them heavenward. And having started in this path, the last must come, the Inquisition to reach the heart, to save them from ruin. Never forget the Inquisition was never a punishment for wickedness, but to save souls from hell. They did not torment a man because he was wicked, but to get him to confess, for that would bring pardon, and to ensure his safety. They would then kill him while holy, that he could not have a chance to sin again. Then is not the Inquisition the very theory of the Sunday observance? Now I do not say that the Inquisition in this country will be the same as in Rome, but the same practice will bring the same result here as in Rome. And the third angel's message says that death will be decreed against all who will not observe Sunday in opposition to the Sabbath. Now all who advocate Sunday laws do not see all this, or do all expect a theocracy, but all their arguments are theocratical ones, and lead to all the results I have enumerated. Many would be horrified if they thought their action would lead to this, but they will be led along step by step until they do not see the end just as it must come. Now another thing, the canon of Laodicea cursed those who kept the Sabbath. Why was this necessary? Because there were people keeping the Sabbath, and they were warning the people against the fraud. So the bishops were compelled to stop belittling the Sunday. Now who do the national reformers say are the real opposers of the Sunday observance? Is it not the Seventh-day Adventists? This they admit and say it is the hardest of all to meet, because the opposition comes from the Bible record. When the statement was once made that Adventists not only wanted to keep the seventh day, but tried to break down the observance of Sunday, and the question was asked what should be done, the reply was, they must not be allowed to take such a course. That is what they expect to do to us. God has given the message to us, and the course we must take is to try to destroy all respect for the Sunday, because it is a day for which no man should have any respect.